It's really lovely to be here again. And because our mind wanders all the time, we do need to come back and reset, check in with the breath, check in with our train of thought, and begin again. So yesterday was Super Tuesday, and there's just so much, I think, anxiety around what is happening in our political world right now. And wherever we are in our opinions, wherever we stand, I think that this is a very challenging time. So I want to talk about that a little bit. I really want to bring in what's actually really going on in so many of our lives, not just our personal lives, but in the wider culture that we are all in some way exposed to the degree that we choose, and also to the degree that is just out in our worlds. So for myself, I am noticing a lot of discomfort, a lot of anxiety, a lot of suffering in me as I watch this political situation unfold. Because I want things to be the way I want them to be. And not necessarily how they are, but more importantly, I'm noticing the suffering that I am feeling around my fear of how they might be. And I think that that applies to any of us wherever we are in whatever our belief systems are. It is scary to face living in a way with around things that scare us, how things might be. And I think that in many ways, fear is typically always about the future. Does that make sense? Fear is about the future. Because right now, right in this very moment, we're sitting together. We've had a lovely meditation. We are here with like minds in the dedication to our practice, is my hunch. And so when we come right here into this moment, we're okay. But the fear comes when we think about what's coming next. So how do we manage our lives through this time, through any time that is frightening? And so I think that I think about practice. Can practice support us? And I think, of course, practice supports us. That's why we are here. But how does it support us? So that brings me to thinking about the Four Noble Truths. That the first one is that in life there is suffering, for sure. We know this. Life is difficult for everybody. And we also know that there is a cause. And again, this cause is our deep desire, this grasping of holding on to how we want things to be and pushing away of how we don't want them to be, and the friction that comes in the middle of how are they actually and where are we in that place. I heard a really great description of the cause of suffering is like if you rub your arm on a brick wall and you just do it once or twice, it just is a little scratchy, right? You know, it doesn't really hurt too much. But if you keep rubbing and you keep rubbing, it's going to get raw and it really is painful. And that's where the suffering happens. So when we continue to struggle, this struggling mind about, I want it like this, I don't want it like that, that's the cause of our suffering. We get road rash or brick wall rash. And then the third noble truth, that there is a possibility of the ending of suffering. And as Sylvia always teaches, peace is possible. And I've been thinking to myself at times, is that true? Is peace possible? And I have to believe it is. And my sense is that you might feel the same way. That when we get scared, we wonder, is a peaceful mind possible? Is the possibility of a non-struggling mind available to me? And sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, because we're human, because this is our experience. So this is why we need our practice to come back over and over again, so we can have these moments of all right, I can breathe with this. In this moment, I am right here. I can breathe with this. So I have to rely on practice to show me that, for sure. So there are some little tools that I like to use for myself that I want to share with you that are, they're kind of like the fire extinguisher. When things are really difficult, what do? To manage. So here are the three acronyms, and you might know them. Stop, wait, wait, or wait, wait, stop, and I'll tell you what these are. Stop is exactly that. S is for stop. T, take a breath, tune in. O, observe, open. P, pause, and then proceed. And maybe proceeding is continuing to pause, park it, just rest. So stop, stop, take a breath, check out what's going on, observe, open to the possibilities of what is here, and then proceed. Wait, what am I thinking? You know, how often do we not pause to check out what we're thinking or not thinking? We're so lightning fast, aren't we? And the next wait comes from Sylvia, which is, why am I talking? Pretty good, isn't it? Why am I talking? So we stop and we wait. We check out what we're thinking. We choose our words carefully, our intention behind what we say. And this is how we come around to what is mindfulness. Mindfulness, so often in the secular world now, when you hear it defined, the very common accepted definition is the moment-to-moment, non-reactive, non-judgmental awareness of whatever is happening right now. But it doesn't say in that definition for what purpose. And I think that is at the heart here. Why are we doing this? What is the purpose of developing this awareness? Now, I like to change the language of non-reactive and non-judgmental to open-heartedness, because I think that we can get a little tripped up with what is non-judgmental. I think that we kind of know what that is, but you know, we want to separate out the judgmental mind from the discerning mind. We need to have judgment. We talk about good judgment, poor judgment. So when I think of non-judgmental and non-reactive, that ability to wait and see what's happening, I think that's open-heartedness, that we come to our experiences with some curiosity. And curiosity is another piece of mindfulness that is critical, that we can actually say, what am I thinking? What am I noticing? And to have that ability to just pause a little bit before we get the lightning fast reaction, which is just what we do. It's so human to do this. But our practice really helps us put the intentional pause in there. And when we get triggered and we feel that reactivity, to actually know that that's what it is. And to be able to say, I need to take a breath. Even if it's just a breath, is enough time to bring down our reactivity. So I like to think of stop, wait, wait, and this definition of open-heartedness. And it's what I was talking about this morning, or pointing to in our meditation, about we come to practice approaching it with a warm heart. That idea that when we sit down to practice, our practice is there for us. It's a dear friend that really supports us. And it's not just in our sitting practice. Our practice is with us always. So there's another way to look at the Four Noble Truths, and this is another fun twist on it that comes from a Vipassana teacher, a monastic. His name is Ajahn Brahm. Anybody familiar with Ajahn Brahm? Do you know about him? He's a British man who has a center in Australia, I think Perth, but I don't know that for sure. And he's very funny, and I enjoy his perspective. So this is what he says. Instead of, with the first noble truth being in life there is suffering, what he says is, there is happiness. In life, there is happiness. Huh, isn't that great? And that it's our birthright. It is our birthright, this happiness. And we know that stuff gets covered over, that our awareness and our hearts are good from the beginning. And it's like the open sky, but weather happens. And we know that. So there is happiness. And I like to think of it as we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all of us are created equal with certain inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Or maybe it's not the pursuit of happiness, but we actually are coming back to our happiness. So that's the first one. Second one, there is a cause of happiness. So what are the causes of happiness? Letting go of our need to have things be the way we want them to be is a cause of happiness. But what I really we're going to focus on today are the paramis, or the paramitas in Sanskrit, parami in Pali. And these are the natural expressions of the beautiful heart. And they include generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. I think that when we work with all of these aspects of our beautiful heart, they are a direct cause and path to happiness. And some of you may be familiar with Sylvia's book called Pay Attention for Goodness Sake, which is her very beautiful exploration of the paramis. It's in the bookstore. The third truth here is, instead of, and there is an end to suffering, there is abiding happiness. When the mind subsides, we can abide in this happiness. And the fourth is, there is a path leading to abiding happiness, which is the Eightfold Path. But I want to focus today on the second and third of these, that there is a cause of happiness and there is abiding happiness, looking at it through the paramis. And I think as we work with our mindfulness practice from the place of open-heartedness, this open-heartedness turns into good-heartedness as we practice, because our open-heartedness brings the warmth. But as we work with this, we start to develop our natural capacity towards generosity and living an ethical life, renunciation, etc. So let's just start with the beginning of how we can look at developing our own happiness or re-recognizing it through these paramis. Generosity. Generosity comes from fundamentally not feeling needy. When we have a sense of enoughness in us, we can share our resources. And how we share our resources looks different for everybody. This is not just about giving financial resources. This is about our willingness to be present with whomever we're with, to be able to look in the eye of the person on the street and say hello. We give our attention. We give our presence. I love what the Buddha taught about generosity, that it supports us repeatedly and in three ways. The first way, in forming the intention to be generous, it causes happiness. In the actual giving of whatever it is that we're giving is another cause of happiness. And remembering our acts of generosity brings us happiness. So that's generosity. Morality. You know, morality is a word that you might feel triggered by or not. So we can call it ethical practice. I see it in the same way. And this is when we're looking at the precepts. The precepts, the five lay precepts that we work with that all center around non-harming. By undertaking the training or perhaps making the vow not to harm life, but in its opposite, to do what we can to support life, our own especially, the second precept of not taking anything which isn't freely given. Well, let's apply generosity to that. That's actually not so much a commandment about don't do, but what can we do to offer? So I think the not taking is actually supported by what can we give. And then wise speech, of course, being careful with our speech and being careful with our sexuality, our expressions of sexuality, so it doesn't harm anybody else. And the fifth one is watching what we take in, what kinds of intoxicants we take in that may cloud the mind to cause heedlessness. And this particularly around this whole political time is how do we take in the media? And for me, taking in the media clouds my mind. And the heedlessness that comes from that is how I get all stirred up and upset and scared and angry. And then how that might play out in my life. Renunciation. Can we let go of our loyalty to our own opinions? How do we exercise restraint in our ways of looking at the world? The Buddha said at the end of the Metta Sutta, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one is not reborn into this world, meaning we can get out of this constant cycle of suffering. So each one of these paramis, as I go through them, they're huge topics, and I'm giving a little short definition of them for sure. When I'm currently teaching a course on the paramis, and I'm getting very inspired every week by whatever we're talking about, and I was particularly inspired a week ago in talking about renunciation, because as I'm getting stirred up about how I want things to be, when I can actually intentionally let it go, and that I can look at my opinions and how they direct my thoughts, if I can just let that settle, it's a little bit easier. And when we look at opinions, there are many more opinions in this room than there are people, right? I mean, you know, we all have so many opinions. Can we even just see how they run us? Which leads to wisdom, right? That's the next parami, the capacity to see clearly out of the fruit of our practice as we learn and as we get to know ourselves and our own minds, insight arises. The more we practice, the more wisdom is developed. And that's why another reason we have to continue to practice, because when practice falls off, as many of us understand, because practice goes in cycles, our wisdom also decreases a little bit. And the Buddha said that in the Dhammapada, and I don't have it specifically here, but with wisdom, with practice, wisdom increases. When practice declines, wisdom decreases. So after wisdom comes energy in the paramis. And this is the kind of energy that we need to bring to practice to keep our practice on the wheels. It shores up mindfulness. This energy allows us to stay aware. And we can talk about how energy supports us seeing the habits of mind that are wholesome and support us. And we can also see the mind habits that don't. So the ones that we see that support us and are nurturing and that are positive, we continue to develop. And when we start to see those habits of mind that we have that aren't supportive, we use energy to let them go. Patience. Patience is this abiding in the present moment that develops tolerance. It develops resilience. It supports our curiosity and understanding of impermanence. We're going to talk a little bit more about patience today once we circle around. Truthfulness. You know, this is where our wise speech practice comes in. And also our practice of awareness. What do we actually know to be true? That takes a little work to step back and get some perspective on that. But when we come from a place of non-harming and we come from a commitment with our speech, truthfulness can flow a little easier. And determination, that's the next one. Determination in our practice and in developing our heart comes from a continual rechecking in with our motivation and our intentions with whatever we are doing, certainly around practice. Why are we here? What is the motivation to practice? What is our intention? And this comes back to mindfulness of being aware and an open-heartedness to what end. And the end, I hope our intention and motivation for this is to develop this skillful, compassionate, loving attitude towards ourselves, towards our lives, and in our lives. So we live a kinder, wise life. I heard a story from another teacher about one of her students as he was practicing and developing this determination that he had tattooed on the palms of his hand. On one hand, it said, "I love you." The other hand, "Keep going." Isn't that sweet? "I love you. Keep going." And I don't think you have to tattoo it on the palms of your hand, but you can let it sink into your heart. You could put it on your bathroom mirror or on your computer screen, somewhere where you're reminded about the beauty and the value of this practice. Loving kindness is next, right? This kind-heartedness, this friendliness. My favorite definition of metta, the Pali word for loving kindness, comes from John Peacock, who's a scholar in England. And he says it's to grow fat with friendliness. Isn't that great? to grow fat with friendliness. So we don't have to like everybody, right? We're not going to. We can't. But we can have a warm heart, and we can have well-wishing. We can say, "I hope your day goes well." That goes a long way, especially when we mean that. It's a dismantling of ill will. And it lets us know, you know, those places in us where we're still hanging on to the, "I don't like that one." And we just notice it. Oh, okay, you know. May I feel okay in this moment? Omitting none, the Buddha says. It's hard work. It's really hard work. We apply that to what's happening in our political lives right now. And can we omit none? It's really difficult when our fear and our anger is stoked to say, okay, this person who has so much anger, when we see the level of anger and hate and intolerance that is happening in our culture, to blame and to dislike and to dismiss and to cut them out. But can we get a little bit underneath that and say, what happened to this person? Where is this thinking coming from? What's happening? That helps us dismantle our ill will a little bit. The Dalai Lama calls it internal disarmament. I like that a lot, this internal disarmament. Sylvia talks about loving kindness as casting a spell of kindness out into the world, and it just lands wherever it lands. Equanimity is the last parami, this balance in the storm. How do we not get knocked over? I like to think of equanimity as one of those blow-up dolls that has sand in the bottom. Do you remember those, you know, and you punch them and they fall over, but they pop right back up? So we find our equanimity all the time by noticing how we get blown around a bit and we come back. But we need all of these paramis to support us. I read recently in Joseph Goldstein's book on mindfulness that of these 10 paramis, patience and equanimity are the foundations upon which all the others rest. I'm thinking about that. You know, you might think about that too. I just read that the other day and I've been chewing on that a little bit in my own practice. But here's what Sylvia says in her book about patience. The practice of patience develops the habit of abiding by understanding this will change and it cannot be other yet, and is supported by cultivating tranquility. and manifests as tolerance. The practice of patience develops the habit of abiding by understanding this will change and it cannot be other yet, and is supported by cultivating tranquility and manifests as tolerance. So I like thinking about patience, especially now when I feel turned up a bit. And Suzuki Roshi, here's what he says about patience. Suzuki Roshi, you might know, is the founder of San Francisco Zen Center. He says, the usual Japanese word nin, N-I-N, for patience is patience. But perhaps the better word is constancy. You must force yourself to be patient, but in constancy, there is no particular effort involved. There is only the unchanging ability to accept things as they are. Patience can actually be non-acceptance. Nin is the way we cultivate our own spirit. Nin is our way of continuous practice. I think that's a very interesting concept to look at patience and constancy. And when we are stirred up and we get that thought, I just need to be patient, is that something we're forcing ourselves to do? Is patience actually non-acceptance of what is going on? I don't know. It's another piece of practice that I think is worth thinking about and reflecting on. That if patience can actually manifest as constancy, as this unchanging ability to accept things as they are, we have a much deeper foundation to respond wisely. And again, this accept things as they are is not the moral acceptance, whether it's acceptable or unacceptable. It's the acknowledging. It's the capacity to say it's like this. I'll tell you a story in a moment. My husband's family lives in a very conservative, small community on the shore of Lake Michigan in Wisconsin. And we've gone to visit the family every year we go a lot for 30 years or so. And they live at the end of a dirt road, literally right on the lake, in a very modest 1960s little cottage that they've made into a permanent home. And it has this very sweet little screen porch. And we go every summer and we have big family dinners at this table on the screen porch. And there are all kinds of people who show up, whether it's a neighbor who lives up the lake, they come for dinner. And we're just there. And there's grandparents and us and the grandchildren, and usually 10 people for dinner all the time. So it was, I think, the night of our arrival. I'm going to back up a little bit. In the dynamic of our family, we have an agreement not to talk too much about politics. You can relate, right? Because there are so many different views. And my husband and I come from Humboldt County, from Arcata, which is a pretty progressive, liberal community. And where his family is from is really the other end of the galaxy. So we really care for each other. And so we have this longstanding agreement to not talk politics because it's not wholesome. And we've learned that lesson. So here we were in this summer evening, having dinner, and we had just arrived. My husband and I had just arrived. I think that my adult son was also there. And my mother-in-law was sitting at the head of the table to my right, and she said something very matter-of-factly about, she thought that in Idaho there was there were a lot of white supremacists. And I said, equally as matter-of-factly, I said, yeah, you know, I think that Idaho is a libertarian state. At which point, my father-in-law, who was sitting on the other end of the table, reared back in his seat and said, wait a minute, you're calling me a white supremacist? And I thought, oh my God, oops, I just stepped in it. And I started to say no, at which point my mother-in-law slammed her hand on the table and said, that's it, in her very decisive, we're putting an end to this political conversation right now. You guys just got here. Stop it. So we did. We just let it go, and the conversation went on to whatever else we were talking about. And that was the end of it for 5 or 6 days. Now, in this town, there is an American flag there unlike anything I've ever seen. It is so big that the flagpole for it is, I don't know how many feet it goes up, but it had to be placed by a crane because the flag itself, each of the stripes is 13 feet high. 13 feet high. And there are 13 stripes, right? So 13 times 13 is like, you know, 160 or something like that. I have to do that math really fast. What was it? 169 feet is this flag. So imagine the strength of the flagpole that has to hold that. So I've never seen anything like it. So 5 or 6 days later, we're out on a morning walk, and this is a place that has really, it's very beautiful. There's lots of dairy farms, and it's along the lake, and we are on this paved, nice, flat path that meanders in between ponds with cattails and frogs and birds, and it was a lovely morning, and my mother-in-law and son were walking together, and my father-in-law and my husband and I were walking three abreast, and my father-in-law was talking about the change in the demographic of the community and that it was becoming more and more people of Muslim background were moving into the community and what that meant for the community as a whole. So I could feel my heart start beating a little bit and this unrest in me start to well, and I just thought, you're just walking. Just walk and listen and breathe. Use this for practice time. Walk, listen, and breathe. And that worked for a little bit. And now my husband was walking in the center of us, and at one point my father-in-law sort of leaned forward and looked over at me, and he said, and you called me a name the other day. And I just stopped and I said, you know, I am really sorry. I am so sorry that that's how it felt to you. It's not what I meant at all. I was really just saying that I think that there are a lot of libertarians who live in Idaho, and that was it. And I wasn't intending to be insulting or derogatory in any way. I'm really sorry about that. So the conversation then went on to him talking more about what is libertarianism and its and what is the Constitution, its relationship to the Constitution. And I just listened, and I knew I just needed to be in this conversation because I actually wanted to learn about his perspective. And since he had accepted my apology, it changed the tone, and he said, okay. So he talked and talked for a bit, and then he looked at me and he said, now you know, Webster's defines me as a heathen, as somebody who doesn't believe in God. And I just looked at him and I said, well, maybe you don't have to believe Webster's. And so he stopped and he looked at me and he kind of smiled. And I said, you know, we've been around each other for the last 30 years. And I wonder if what we could do when we get into these conversations is just say to each other, would you be willing to tell me what you mean by that? Instead of us feeling that reactivity of that we are, our views are on opposite sides of the galaxy, it's a really big black hole in between, yet we really care for each other. So would we be willing to suspend our loyalties to our own opinions long enough to say, would you be willing to tell me what you mean by that? And he looked at me and he said, you know, I think you and I can do that. but I don't think the rest of the world can do that. And I said, how about you and I just try it? Let's just you and I do it. So he said, okay. And he had asked me a little bit about what I was up to and, you know, in my life. And at the time I was doing my mindfulness teacher training at UCLA, and I was telling him about that. And I said, so, you know, this mindfulness stuff that I've told you about, the stuff that I teach, I said, this is how it works. This is what we do with each other. And he just looked at me and he smiled. And that was the end of that conversation. And a couple days later, when my husband and I were getting ready to leave, we had a very early morning flight, and so we were all up in the wee hours of the dawn saying goodbye. And he came over and he gave me a hug and he said, we did good, didn't we? And even now I get chills sharing that story, because we did. We really did. And we don't really talk politics too much, because it's really not necessary. We pretty much understand each other's position. But he's my husband's father and my children's grandfather. And I love him. So this is what our practice does for us, is it helps us get a little perspective. And I want to be able to apply that as we go through these primaries a little bit, because it makes me, I'm a little bit more supported that way. So I want to read you, this is from a poem from William Stafford. It's called The Way It Is. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you can do stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. Let me read that to you again. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. So we don't let go of our practice. So I just want to bring in a couple other things, and then we'll have some time to talk with each other. So as I've been thinking about how anger clouds the mind, how this intolerance and hate and how we see this manifesting, I pulled out Shantideva, The Way of the Bodhisattva. And this is a couple of stanzas from him. All the good works gathered in 1,000 ages, such as deeds of generosity and offerings to the Buddhas, a single flash of anger shatters them. No evil is there similar to anger, no austerity to be compared with patience. Steep yourself, therefore, in patience, in various ways, insistently. I like that last instruction, insistently. There's an indefatigability that comes when we bring this energy to our practice, this commitment to practice, this determination that helps support us. So this is what the Dalai Lama says about those two stanzas from Shantideva. As a destructive force, there is nothing as strong as anger. An instant of anger can destroy all the positive actions. Indeed, there is no fault as serious as anger. Patience, on the other hand, as a discipline that neutralizes and prevents us from succumbing to anger, is unrivaled. Through it, the suffering we endure from the heat of the negative emotions is relieved. It is therefore of the utmost importance that we resolve to practice patience, gaining inspiration through reflecting on its advantages and on the terrible effects of anger. So patience as a discipline that neutralizes and prevents us from succumbing to anger is unrivaled. So maybe that's why patience and equanimity are the foundations for the other paramitas. And I'm going to choose to believe the Dalai Lama, that he's right. Seriously. So can we practice patience? Can we explore this in ourselves when we get upset and we get scared? Can we say, okay, it's like this right now. Can I bring this warm-heartedness, this open-heartedness to myself right now, to this conversation, into our convictions? And this, and everything that I'm talking about does not mean that we don't have convictions, that we don't have a foundation of our own ethical life, of what we believe in. But can we soften around that enough to say, can you let me know what you mean by that? Abraham Lincoln, he says it really simply. When I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That is my religion. So maybe it's not so complicated, right? You know? We know what it is to do good. We know that in our bones. And that's when the Buddha said at the very end, move into the future with confidence. We take that from ourselves, and we use that. So we have some time to talk. Any kinds of questions, any comments? Yeah, we'll get the mic. And please, when you get the mic, please tell us your name again. I'm working on this.
I'm Adrian.
I don't think it's on.
It's green.
Try it again.
Hold it up to your... I'm Adrian. No. No. Maybe it's the lever over here. Patience.
Yes, exactly. We will have patience.
I can talk really loud.
That's
fine.
Talk
really loud. This other one isn't working.
There may be a switch in there that you need to turn the mics on.
Oh, maybe.
Do you know where this one is?
Because
hand mic. Here we go. Here's one.
Try again.
Hello.
Nope.
No. Does that one work? That she's holding.
Yeah. No, it's.
Oh, there we go.
It's great. Bad, but. Go for it.
Okay. Whoa.
Thank you, Adrian.
So I'm by nature an impatient person. And so I've thought a lot about the essence of patience. Like, what is it to pull it apart? What is it? What are the components of being patient? And I've thought about and come to the conclusion that it's about hope and optimism. And which I don't think the Buddha, I don't think those words are in his vocabulary, but hope and optimism, because when I am impatient, I can see my mind going into catastrophic thinking. Mm-hmm. And if I can stop that and be optimistic, or at least stop the thinking, but the next step is to be optimistic. Like, yes, the traffic will continue. Or my daughter is waiting to hear about a job. And I've realized that my desire or my fear that she won't get it and the catastrophic thing, like she'll be dependent until she's 50 and then she'll, you know, is not being optimistic. And so the hope, to remember the hope and the optimism around this will be okay, it will work out, stops me from calling her every night and saying, have you heard yet, you know? And that patience makes me a better person, somebody that, you know, my daughter might want to be around. And so hope and optimism.
Thank you, Adrian. That's beautiful. You know, we need that, right? We need hope. We need optimism, because when we feel hopeless or pessimistic, it's painful. It's really painful. So I think that just churning around what is patience for yourself There's so much mindfulness in that, and there's so much wisdom in everything that you just said, that it's an easier place to be. So maybe where the Buddha talked about hope and optimism is, I think, somewhat move into the future with confidence. I think there are lots of places that we can look at how joy and loving kindness and compassion and how these things bring some happiness, which can infuse our hope. We can infuse our optimism. Joanna Macy says a really important thing, though, about hope. She says, are you familiar with Joanna Macy, peace mm-hmm. activist, very important person in the engaged Buddhist world? She says, we are not required to be hopeful or hopeless. We're just required to show up. That gives a little space around that, I think, that if we can just show up with who we are and how we are, I think it works out. But as a practice, when you get caught in that impatience, it's just to notice that, to come back to the body, come back to the heart. May I feel okay in this moment? And there is some trusting of the unfolding that is important. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Anybody else?
Hi, I'm Francesca.
Francesca.
And thank you for your eloquent discussion. It was just, you had me at the edge of my seat.
You're welcome.
And thank you for bringing up the topic of politics and what goes on. Yesterday, my daughter and I consult with each other once a day as if we're going to be, you know, we're going to know what the outcome of this whole thing is going to be. And we somehow will be able to control it, you know. And so we had this lively conversation in the car about what was happening yesterday. And I mean, we could go on for hours. Well, she was waiting to pick up my granddaughter from school. So my granddaughter comes into the car. She's going to be 12 next week. And I said, Amanda, how was your day? And she goes, it was wonderful. In history, we're studying Buddhism. And we're studying about the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path.
Wow.
And I went, oh, my God. And I said, and what do you think? She goes, I can be happy. And everything my daughter and I had said for the last half hour just dissolved.
Wow.
In that one moment. And it was so beautiful. And then later on that night, I said to her, do you think your classroom would like to have me come? I can volunteer and we could do a Buddhist meditation together. She goes, I'll ask my teacher tomorrow. I said, okay. And so my daughter gets on the phone. She goes, it's not going to work. And I said, why not? It's really a Christian community up here. And I said, well, if it doesn't work there, then maybe we can meditate when I come up to the house. And, you know, so... But it was like just to have her aliveness and happiness and lightness about it just shifted that whole energy.
Francesca, what a beautiful story.
Yeah.
I can be happy.
Yeah.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Yeah.
Remind us. We need it. We need it.
Yeah.
And how great that in her school that they're getting just a little glimpse. And if that's what she gets, imagine how that can change her world and her friend's world.
Yeah, it was incredible. Yeah. So thank you for
bringing
that up.
Thank you. Okay. Anybody else?
This whole question of anger and patience, it's hard to be patient when you're angry. Once you get there, it's unplugging that. So it may be great to hold back anger, but once the anger occurs, patience doesn't seem to mean anything at all.
I think that's right. I think that we all know the experience of anger, that we get hijacked, that our hearts, our wisdom, it's hijacked completely. And it happens actually because there is a neuro biological component that is happening in the brain that literally hijacks out of out of the prefrontal cortex, which is our higher thinking center. So deep in the brain is the amygdala and the insula, both of which are structures that are present to keep us safe and alive, that get triggered with fight, flight, freeze. We know this, that when we get reactive and angry, we have cortisol and acetylcholine and different neurotransmitters that flood the brain, literally flood the brain. And what we're left with is all of this raw emotion that might manifest as anger. And what we have to do is then stop and wait so we can let things settle back down in the brain so we can think again. Because when the brain is flooded, it actually blocks the access to the prefrontal cortex, and we can't think. I mean, we can all picture children who are having a meltdown, and our attempts to say, calm down, or whatever it is, and they say, I can't. They can't. So having a place where we can say, all right, I'm out of my mind right now with anger. We are out of our minds with anger. To be able to have the ability to just stop and wait and say, I can talk to you about that later when I can think clearly. So we know that it's natural to get triggered. But what happens with practice is that we get a lot more intimate with our own habits of mind and how they affect us. And so we can catch it sooner, and we're not as triggered by the things that maybe used to trigger us. Things that, you know, we can see. Again, we can come back to the political situation. We've got a couple of choices. We can see what's going on, and we can feel our triggering. We can feel how it's making us angry. Or we can say, oh my gosh, I'm getting really angry. I think I'll turn the TV off. Or can I be here long enough to listen to what this person is saying? So you're right. How to apply patience when we're completely hijacked, we probably can't. But we learn to get to know it over time.
The other thing about the politics, it's almost like you can't control the damn stuff. So I'm just like on, you know, to the point of just saying, let me know who wins, okay? That's how I feel about it.
Right. Well, maybe there's a lot of skill in that. Because what we can each actually do is vote. So if we each vote, we're making a statement in that way. And when we have greater breadth and tolerance to engage in the process, some of us do, some of us don't. And if that's not what you can do, don't.
Yeah, I mean, you give money and you go, now you got something in the game, you know, damn it.
Yeah. So we do need to end, but before we end, a couple of things. First of all, thank you so much for being here to practice with all of us. On the back table is a sign-up list. If you're interested in being on my email newsletter, I don't send out a lot, but I can let you know when I'm going to be back here. I also write a blog that I put out once or twice a month, and if you would like to receive that blog, you can let me know. It's obvious on the clipboard. A couple of my cards are there. The other thing I want to invite is for John, who spoke last week so beautifully about his upcoming trip, and he has a couple things he would like to share with us. We have a mic for John.
Thank you, Heidi. I'll try to make this quick. Those of you who were here last week, I talked for a few minutes about going to Lesvos, Greece, a week from Monday to help the refugees as they make their journey up to Europe. And I shared with you that I had established a fund to raise money to go directly to aid the refugees. And last Wednesday, when I spoke to you, this fund was at about $3,500. And as of today, it's up to about $5,500. And $2,000 came through you, as well as others who listened to Sylvia's podcast. It's amazing, these people who listen to podcast donated. So I want to just take this opportunity to thank all of you. and those who are listening, who contributed, but also those who didn't. You know, I'm not here to pressure you or make you feel guilty, or, you know, the money is not the important thing. It's really not the important thing. It will help, but it's more your compassion, your support, your caring about the situation that the refugees are going through. That is really much more important. I just want to share with you a little bit. I've been reading a lot about what the refugees are going through from people who are on the ground, the volunteers. And you won't read this stuff in the main media and the press or on TV, but it's getting to be very desperate right now. And I don't know what the situation will be a week from now when I leave. But they've closed the border in Macedonia. They've stopped ferrying the refugees from the Greek islands to Athens. So now there's thousands and thousands of refugees who are still coming, but who are now stuck on Lesbos, on the island, in Greece, and they can't go. And on the border of Greece and Macedonia, these refugees are being tear gassed. And I've seen clips of Turkish Coast Guard shooting water from water cannons at the boats trying to arrive. So I'm a little nervous now in terms of what the situation might be a week from now, because desperate people will do desperate things. So I wanted to just give you a picture that, you know, like 30 or 40% of these refugees are children and families who are traveling. And I mentioned last time that it's about probably 9 o'clock at night in Turkey and Greece right now as we're sitting here. And these refugees are waiting to board on these little rafts to go across the Aegean Sea. And why would a parent knowingly put their child or their family on this little raft, not knowing whether they're going to make it? Several thousands have already drowned trying to cross the Aegean Sea. But why would someone make that decision to do that? And I heard an answer to that, and that is because the alternative is worse. The alternative is worse. If you can just kind of think of that parent making that kind of decision. So the last thing I just want to say is, in terms of the practice, is that in the midst of darkness, there is light. In the midst of evil, there is goodness. In the midst of hatred, there is love. In the midst of bigotry and intolerance, there's inclusion and acceptance. And that helps sustain me, because it's very easy to get depressed, sad, angry about what's happening in the world. But I also think of the thousands of volunteers who have traveled from all over the world to come and help. I think of World War II and all the families that took in the Jews and hid them from the Nazis. I think of people who helped the slaves in the Underground Railroad. I mean, these are people like you and me. They weren't famous people, but something compelled them to act, as you were talking about. And I think it's because, it's really great because it ties into what you said today in terms of, you know, our true nature, our core nature is one of goodness and love and compassion. And we can't forget that. It gets clouded over, but our true nature is one of our spiritual self. Our authentic self is one of compassion, kindness, and love. And I'm hoping that as I go on this trip, I take with me your support and your compassion and love, because that's what's going to sustain me and strengthen me, knowing that that's how you're viewing the situation. It's not about the money, so.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.